Hi, I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today, I welcome to the show Tom Reynolds. Tom is a professor of theology at the University of Toronto, and he also is the parent of a disabled son who has autism and some other related disabilities. I too felt a kinship with Tom because my son Nathan has autism, some intellectual delays, and some learning disabilities. I'm happy to tell you that the music you're hearing on this episode was furnished to me by Tom, who is also a jazz musician, and so enjoy that throughout the episode. I hope that this discussion about the theology of disability, as well as the theology of suffering, is something that will ignite your imagination and enable you to be more aware of those around you who need grace and acceptance and belonging. The theology of disability asks important questions about God, such as what can we understand about God through this disabled, and what does disability tell us about God and about ourselves? So I hope you enjoy this episode, and leave your comments at sparkmymuse.com.
Hi, my name is Tom Reynolds. I teach theology at Emmanuel College here in Toronto, Canada. Emmanuel College is part of Victoria University, which is part of the University of Toronto, and it's affiliated with the Toronto School of Theology. So it's a University of Toronto is a big place, and Emmanuel is sort of housed in that larger network of schools. But I'm lucky to be here in a multicultural, interfaith, great city. With NAM games about to start right now.
Oh, wow. Must be a lot of traffic.
That's true. It's a lot of traffic. But I like to cycle, and there are great bike paths in Toronto. And So I've been down to where the Athletes Center is. And it's kind of fun and exciting, although I think I will stay away from the centers of the games themselves because it will be a traffic nightmare.
And then your work has concentrated on, in recent years, it's moved away from... How I became familiar with you, I think it's moved away from that, but you can clarify that my introduction to you was through your book called Vulnerable Communion, and that was in one of the texts I read during a theology of suffering class, and I focused particularly on the theology of disability based on some of my personal experience as the mother of a special needs child, and I was really drawn into your story and your work, and so maybe you can talk about a little of that work and some of what you're doing with that.
Yeah, well, it's still a prominent feature of my work and how I teach. I teach an introduction to theology class for ministers in training because Emmanuel is a seminary. And in that class, one of the things that I stress is that theology is personal. It's not just an abstract discipline done disconnected from the real world concerns of the church and people living their lives. And for me, as a parent of a child on the autism spectrum, my son Chris and his life with me has challenged me to rework everything I thought was settled, theologically speaking. And so it's an ongoing part of my work, and really what initiated my starting to write the book Vulnerable Communion. At the time, I was in Green Bay, Wisconsin, teaching at a small Catholic school. And I didn't really know of any kind of literature on the theology of disability. So I started reading and discovered there were some great books out there, but not a lot. since the time of my writing, the whole field of theology and disability has really emerged as something important for churches. But at the time, it wasn't really a prominent discussion among theologians or even taught in school. And so I started writing that book as a way to work through some of the challenges that I faced theologically speaking. And I shouldn't say the first thing was that I realized that my relationship with Chris meant that disability isn't a problem to figure out, but rather it's about a person who I love and live with and care with and for, my son Chris. And so I radically reoriented my theological perspective. I remember teaching a class one day, and we were on a topic of God's providence, you know, one of those thorny theological questions. Is how is God related to the world, and does God control everything? And I realized that I had been perceiving disability as, in effect, something that was a problem, that somehow God causes disability. And we see those examples in Scripture, you know, as a curse for punishment, or maybe a cross to bear, an opportunity for God to heal, or, you know, a way for people without disabilities to display charity, or a kind of moral lesson for others, you know, the typical there, but for the grace of God go I. And I realized that Chris didn't fit any of those categories. In fact, my love for him and relationship with him exploded those categories. And so I was a confused theology professor, really having to rethink what faith in God meant and what it meant to be you know, in a relationship of love with my son, whose life was considered by society to be abnormal and somehow faulty. And so I combed Scripture, and I thought through my own experience and read some of the literature, and that book came out, which is, you know, basically a labor of my love for Chris. And I didn't think anybody'd be interested in publishing it. I actually wrote it for me. And then I found a publisher and an editor who was really understanding, because the writing of the book took some time, because my life is, you know, not doesn't function according to time schedules of efficiency, because I'm involved advocating and caring with my son. So, yeah, it was. And when the book came out, you know, I was shocked by that it hit a nerve. And then I met people who are now friends, like Amos Young and Hans Reinders and John Swinton, who were also writing in this field. And suddenly there was a real interest in Christian communities. And thankfully, because church communities have a long way to go to really foster belonging among all people, including people with disabilities. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to say that theology and disability is still a feature of my work. And I'm working on a book now on care, actually, in the theology of care, which continues that rethinking process begun, you know, in 2005, 2006.
Yeah, I know in the book you mentioned some, you know, you get personal in the book, too, about some of the struggles you had with Christian community, a Christian community that didn't really receive you, and how that... And maybe you can explain that a little bit. You do talk about churches who will stress cure over care. And that really struck a nerve with me, because I was in, just as a brief aside, I was in a visiting because of a friend of mine visiting at a church, and the husband-wife pastoral team, I think maybe she thought we were going to regularly attend there. And she approached me, I think, thinking I'd want to hear this, and said, I want you to know that if you come here, we will pray for a cure for your son. And yeah. I thought, I wonder if he had Down syndrome, if she would have said the same thing, if he looked like he had Downs, or, you know, it would be like, can you cure me of my brown eyes? Like, that is how he is. And although the symptoms would be nice if some of the symptoms would lessen and he could adjust a little better to, you know, in a rehabilitative sense, mainstream a little better, but to cure him would be to erase him, I felt. And it really was a little chilling, and I'm sure it was all well-intentioned and everything. She's not a mean bone in her body, yeah. I'm sure, but it was such a disconnect that I was taken aback by that. And maybe you can explain some of your experience.
Yeah, well, there's a range of responses churches often have in encountering people with disabilities and families like yours and mine. And I guess the curing or the will to cure is a first reaction among many who mean well. And so it's a step maybe in the right direction away from just total exclusion, like you're not welcome here. And we don't really care about you. And so, you know, we're going to put up an immediate barrier because disruptions in church are simply not tolerated, and therefore goodbye. Mm. And those kind of experiences, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about those kinds of experiences, maybe not that dramatic, but the cure example. And, you know, I think of cure as a sort of fixing, right? It's a way of containing or erasing, as you say, in order to remake somebody in the image of what's comfortable for non-disabled people and what I like to call normalcy. So churches want to remake, refashion everybody in the image of what they consider to be normal. And it's interesting because it's not really scriptural, but it more or less caters to societal senses of what makes for a productive, efficient, status quo body, among others, who's well-behaved and can fits, you know, fits within the constraints of a very thin margin of human experience. And so the urge to cure, the will to cure is a symptom of that, you know, normalizing practice that happens in faith communities that really I don't think has much to do with scripture, although, you know, it raises the question of the healing narratives and so forth. But I think that the urge to cure is one feature that turns many families and people off because it's a way of still saying you're not welcome. Mm-hmm. You have to be remade and erased and replaced sort of in the image of what we'll tolerate. And I had that experience too. I mean, my son's behavior was a little unruly, and in one church wasn't allowed to come to Sunday school, which meant at the time that, you know, couldn't worship there because without care and assistance, that became impossible. And so we left that church and found another series, after a series of experiences, found eventually a really loving faith community in Green Bay, Wisconsin, that welcomed. And I remember a distinct experience in that church. Part of Chris's diagnosis involves Tourette's syndrome, which involves involuntary motor and verbal tics, especially sometimes when excited. And that could be both positive and negative when he's feeling frustrated or angry, or on the other hand, when there's genuine joy. And I remember sitting in worship because he was older, and one of the elders came up and said, "How can we help you?" And it was like fresh water pouring upon my parched soul to hear, "How can we be of help?" rather than, "You need to do this," or, and it left the agency up to Chris and, you know, caregivers rather than simply requiring conformity. And it turned out in that church experience that people would welcome the verbal tics and sometimes noises because people accepted it as part of the way he communicates rather than being a disruption that punctured the status quo and simply wouldn't be tolerated. It became a way that the community welcomed his way of participating in worship. Mm. That experience was life-giving and, you know, made me realize that, yeah, there's a lot of hope out there, and people of goodwill exist in all kind of faith communities, and it's a matter of helping educate communities into nurturing the best in themselves in terms of showing hospitality, really, to people with disabilities and their allies and families. So I'm sorry for your experience in that, and I can relate, having had negative experiences too, but the desire for a cure is one of the problematic ways that disability is often seen as something faulted, right? Something that has to be fixed and remade in the image of what society thinks is normal, but actually is simply, in many cases, a part of who a person is, and in my son's case, it's part of the loveliness that he is. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think there's still a long way to go, which is why I really do like speaking in faith communities, and I plan to write still, even though it's one of the many different hats I wear in my current position. Mm. But there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, and it's of course, you know, people with disabilities or people who, from a lot of different walks of life, it's just a messier, you know, it's not as neat and tidy, but it's literally the, to me, if your church can't be gracious to people who want to be there, you know, it's really calls into question the purpose of the church to me. And I have to say that my own church, the church family we've been part of for a long time, has, people have really gone out of their way to include Nathan. I think that's the most salient point, and some of the things you speak about too, is that do they get to be full-fledged members, or is it somehow second class, or is it like in my case, I'm thinking of the mascot syndrome, where it's like, hey cutie, you get to be part of our group, but they're not really part of the group. They're kind of, you know, we're going to graciously add you on, but you're not, you know, because we're nice, but it's not like you're one of us, but you're kind of the mascot. But I have to say, our church has done a lot of things right with going the extra mile, and you can speak to that if you'd like.
No, I think that's a really good insight. And there's a range of responses, right? I mean, churches can tolerate, which means sort of put up with, but not really allow participation at all. You know, you can come, but you know, you have to go to this separate room, and your family is treated as second-class citizens, right? And that's kind of a condescending, paternalistic attitude that really doesn't display the love that Christians are called to. And then there's, I mean, for lack of a better word, what I like to call inclusion. Now, that word has a lot of good features too, but often inclusion is more like certain kinds of people are considered outside, and then by the good graces of the community who are an in-group are invited in, but even so still treated as problems to be solved or people to receive the gestures of charity from others, so that they're done people for whom things are done for. I like that, to do for somebody rather than be with. Mm. And inclusion often sounds like, in the way you described it, it's more than just inclusion there. There's a real access in the deepest sense that people are not just opened into spaces they're not just welcomed into spaces. There's real desire and action that facilitates participation and the belonging of all. So I like to call, you know, sometimes churches talk about access, and often that simply means building ramps for people with mobility issues. When in fact access is ongoing and should reflect the people who are there and the people who might be there. And often disability is something that's not expected to show up, and so faith communities are sort of thrown into a panic, as if disability is some issue about outsiders. But really, most of the communities I'm involved with and have a chance to speak with, there are many ranges of disabilities, visible and invisible, including mental health challenges that are already there. And often communities haven't really opened their own perceptions up to who they are. And so it really does mean moving beyond tolerance or inclusion in those senses, and even access in the kind of superficial way of providing, you know, wheelchair ramps and hearing assisted devices, to a deeper sense of maybe even a longing to be together in the most rich sense possible. And I mean, there's a lot of things being written these days, and John Swinton is one of the theologians talking about belonging. And I like to think of belonging as, you know, if you break it apart, you belonged for when you're not there, or when you're not present in the full rich sense of being a part of. So I like the longing theme in there of communities that really desire participation by, for, and with all, rather than some, as you say, being treated as second-class citizens and, you know, people who are there just to receive the gifts of benevolent souls, rather than people who can actually give to a community. So, you know, like John Vanier, who founded L'Arche, likes to say, it's about relationships of giving and receiving that we really thrive as people, not just in giving, though somehow deemed lesser than are somehow needy or faulted. And yeah, I think you touch on a key issue, and communities really become who they are as the people of God when true belonging can happen.
This thing I wanted to approach is this underlying, often unconscious bias where we can engage with this a little bit, of the fear of the stranger idea, and also, and I think personally encountering this, and maybe you can speak to if you personally encountered this, but I grew up in a time when there was no mainstreaming, and the quote retarded kids would go on a different bus to a different school, and you never interacted with them, and that's the thing you absolutely did not want to be associated with, and you did not want people to that was the thing you would get slammed with, that someone would say you're a retard, and that was like the worst thing, you know, or imitating that, and there was a lot of very, you know, it was a very insensitive time compared to, I mean, thank God we've kind of moved past that, and kids are mainstreamed and there's less of it. It's probably more of a subtle prejudice, but it really did. Having a son with special needs, because I, in my infinite foolishness, thought I would have the smartest kids or whatever. You know, I was going to have kids that were athletic and smart and everything, and then this gift comes along. You know, Nathan means gift, and I thought everything got turned upside down with my expectations, of course, but then I had to face the stranger within and the frailty within myself that I found reflected in him, and coming to grips with that in myself, but also as communities, sometimes we will, I think it's mostly unconsciously, but fear weakness and fear, essentially fear vulnerability, like you speak about. And, you know, what was your journey with that, and what are some of those insights that you could speak to?
Well, I appreciated you sharing some of your story and the struggle in yourself, because I too have, well, I shouldn't speak past tense. Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing struggle, because in some ways I like to often say disability and the encounter with disability punctures the illusions of what I think of as my own strengths. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be a great dad. I wanted to be patient and Chris's own uniqueness calls that into question in ways that have been not always, I wouldn't say, you know, blessings, because it's an ongoing struggle. And in the book, you know, I detail some of those things, but I make it about my own journey, because I think it's, and rather something that exposes Chris. And in the book, you know, I talk with him about everything I was sharing, and I didn't want to share anything that he was uncomfortable with. But it's, like you said earlier, it's messy. And it doesn't come tidy in easy wrapped packages that can be spiritualized and moral truths that make people feel happy. It's a messy life that I really can't put together easily. And I know there's some conversation among parents and caregivers with people with disabilities that that talk about, you know, the gift of my child, and that's true in the generic sense. And it's beautiful that Nathan means gift, and I play him in the book with Chris's name as Christ bearer, because I've encountered Christ anew in my relationship with Chris, and yet it's messy, and I can't simply say it's all been a gift. It's been really hard, and I've needed communities, and I've needed to own my own vulnerability and inability to to do this journey alone. In fact, it's quite isolating, I would say. You know, as a parent yourself, sometimes the resources in the community are just not there. And so it's a journey that calls you back into having to rethink, okay, how do I try this? How can I be the best advocate and loving parent possible? And I've not always been successful at doing that. Even though, you know, Chris is doing relatively well and the general contours of the journey have moved in positive directions, but it's a tough one. And I particularly thought of the theme of vulnerability in the book, because that seemed to be the best word to describe what it seems to be, I would say, an epidemic in our society, the fear of vulnerability, the fear of being perceived as weak or unable to perform in ways that are considered valuable by society. And that touches deeply, as I try to talk about in the book, into, you know, myths about autonomy and independence and productivity that go into the how we see ourselves as, you know, modern and postmodern human beings. Somehow we're self-reliant and we get socialized into thinking, I can do this myself. And I think it contributes to what people call ableism, that is the perception of disability as somehow faulted and wrong, and leads to exclusion by a kind of sense that the normal is only the complete seamless productive body. And for me, that's an ongoing challenge, because I'm not as productive, so to speak, and as others, because a lot of my time and energy goes into being with Chris, mm-hmm. and trying to facilitate a good life, or what that might look like for him, and not simply what, you know, I see it mm-hmm. as good. I've had to rethink that constantly. I mean, maybe that resonates with your own experience with Nathan, mm-hmm. but Chris tells me constantly, not your way, Dad, mm-hmm. but mine. Mm-hmm. Listen to me deeply. And so I, you know, in this book on care I'm working on, I'm calling it A Spirituality of Attentiveness, because it's really, it calls me into that space of being attentive to his way, mm-hmm. and listening closely to who he is and what he desires, rather than my own pretense to have, you know, him find the independent, you know, efficient life that society would expect. And yeah, mm-hmm. I think faith communities can help in the process of moving outside these myths of the independent, autonomous human being to recognizing ourselves as vulnerable, interdependent creatures who actually need each other to be whole. Mm-hmm. You look at the scriptures, you know, in the New Testament, there are all sorts of examples about, well, Paul's weakness, for example, that becomes, you know, a kind of prophetic resistance to a society that deems the strong as the only thing of value. And Paul talks about how it's his weakness that actually opens things up. And not like, I mean, that could easily fall into ableist notions, you know, that some people are weaker than others, and I don't think that's what's going on there in 1 Corinthians. I think it's a kind of prophetic exposure of the pretense to strength and you know, normalcy that occupies our society that is actually something that the gospel and God's grace is undercutting. Mm. But, you know, getting back to the personal side of this, it's a struggle for me, and I'm continually growing and learning and trying to open my life to Chris's uniqueness and to be there along with others in the process. I don't know if that resonates with your experience.
Yeah, I think, well, it's what's interesting too is that being able in body and mind, you know, if, especially for some of us who have, you know, had success or had, you know, I don't know, good grades or, you know, has done well and feel successful, that there's this false construct that we aren't only temporarily abled, and that, and I think it's Jean Vanier says, I believe it's him who says that we're all going to be disabled. We're going to have sickness and we're going to get old and weak and die. And that if we even imagine that we're able-bodied, we do have weaknesses and we can find, in a way, find ourselves in that other person because we actually share so much in common with them that we are blind to. And I think it's, you know, that getting acquainted with our own vulnerability is so critical to understanding our humanness in a very beautiful way that someone who's more profoundly disabled doesn't have a choice about, but that you know, it's part of the, it's sort of a brutal lesson, you know. It's like I feel like my son is my teacher, mm-hmm. but not in happy lessons all the time, you know. It's sometimes these very,
yeah, I mean, I feel like, right, church communities often, and you know, I've had people come up to say, oh, you must be so blessed to have Chris as your teacher. And I think that falls into the kinds of, you know, problems of treating disability. Okay, because disability is so disruptive, people have to remake it in the image of normalcy in order for it to be palatable. So they gloss it with spiritual truths and what I would call a kind of obsession with happiness, mm-hmm. you know, that it has to be this positive thing only in terms of spiritual growth. And while in one way that's true, I think you're right, that actually undercuts the real journey, which is about being together as in vulnerable relationships of mutuality. Mm-hmm. Chris isn't there just as my teacher, even though he does teach me. He's there as a unique, loved by God, human being whose life seeks its own flourishing. And in a certain way, his life calls to me to be there with that. And it's more than just being a teacher, although it, like you say, it's part of it. And I can say honestly that the challenge that Chris has meant for me, and I use the word challenge not in a way that reduces it all to just being a difficulty, because mm-hmm. there's been joy too, but the challenge has opened me up to a much richer way of being human, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think those stories are out there among many families. And, you know, John Vanier, who you mentioned, testifies to how he's learned, and Henry Nouwen and others. And I would agree with that. The only thing that I would say is there's more there than in a person than simply being a teacher for others. There's a gifted sense that calls out for relationship in the richest way. And sometimes that can be disruptive and disorienting. And I like the word you used earlier, messy. And it's true, I, you know, one of the things that my relationship with Chris has opened me to is growing up in a tradition where belief was really important, and believing the right things and making sure you could quote scripture and, you know, have, which requires a certain amount of intellectual abilities. And human beings come in all shapes and sizes, and one of the things that I've learned is intellectual capacities vary among everybody. And if I'm going to think about God's relationship of grace with humankind, it requires me to think beyond simply, you know, the ability to repeat doctrines and dogma and quote scripture and understand things like I'm told I should understand. Somehow, as you know, I believe it's 1 Timothy, you know, God desires all to be saved, and God works God's own path of spirituality out in different ways and in different capacities with people, so that, you know, that undercuts my, especially as a theologian, my arrogance mm-hmm. to think that I can map it out mm-hmm. in ways that would be definitive and uniform and universal for all people in all places. I just don't think that's true. And so in a way, I respect the story that you say of Nathan and how his own journey, it's developed in different ways. And with Chris, mm-hmm. who declares himself an atheist, and I always like to tease him and say, well, it depends what God you don't believe in when you say the word. Because maybe you and I both are atheists in a certain way, because there's a lot of different conceptions of God that I don't mm-hmm. believe in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's confronted me with rethinking spirituality as a matter of the heart mm-hmm. and about relationships of belonging mm-hmm. And help me refocus how important being in community really is mm-hmm. beyond simple you know, reading by myself, that it's really in the kind of relationships of mutual belonging that the full image of God is born out.
That is such an interesting point. That is, this gets to a real nugget that, in terms of theology, I know for my son, like I was mentioning, he abstract concepts didn't mean anything to him. You know, God in heaven and God in Jesus in your heart, none of that made any sense to him, and he would just dismiss it because he didn't understand it. And not that I do, but I said to him one time, I don't think this made a breakthrough for him at all, but it made a breakthrough for me. And I said that when you see someone who's loving you, you're seeing God. And there's such a connection between belonging and that, you know, God doesn't have a body, and we get to be the hands and feet of God, hands and feet of Christ, that's how people who have trouble intellectualizing it, that might be the only way they can actually get it. And there's a lot of, like this, like you were talking about, this Abel-centered view of God and view of belief, and it everything turned upside down. I put something out there on my blog, which, you know, a stranger came along and said, I had said something like, I used to think about right belief being the center of understanding God. But my son changed that for me because I realized that God's grace is sufficient for him, and he doesn't have to make a confession of faith. I mean, he could repeat some words or something, but that's obviously not what we're talking about. And then there's a lot of stress too on, you know, you have to confess with your mouth. Well, I know nonverbal autistic people. What does that mean for them? What does that say about God? That they would be excluded based on their ability to not properly vocalize or intellectually conceptualize what he's done for them. And so I wrote some of this out, and someone said, this is so sad that your son would change your theology and you've got it wrong and whatever. And I thought, well, we do worship different gods then, because I'm pretty sure that there isn't a litmus test like that. I mean, there better not be, because that makes no sense. Like, that either God is going to be loving and gracious for these creatures he's made, these people he's made, or you just get in based on your intellectual prowess, you know, that somehow you know, I mean, that is a cruel setup if that's what's going on.
Yeah, and I don't think with you, I don't think that that's, I don't think it's very helpful in the one sense, nor do I think it's actually very Christian. Because when I, and not that I can, you know, define for all, but it seems like I really appreciate Martin Luther's theology of the cross. Maybe you studied this in your course on the theology of suffering, but where Luther was criticizing the pretense of the theologians of the Middle Era, and maybe a bit excessively so, but criticizing the pretense to know exactly what God is and where God works and how. And he talked about at the place where God is most hidden and seemingly absent, the cross, is the place where God is somehow most palpably and vividly revealed in saving ways. And the theology of that opens up lots of implications, like who am I to declare that God's grace only works in some ways, and that God's capacity and God's own infinite mystery is limited to what I would deem or my community would deem adequate. And so I, you know, that's why I say it's not very Christian. I know that sounds harsh in the sense, but, you know, if grace is sufficient and if God's grace is freely given, that really does call into question the kind of, not just ableism, but the kind of pretense to have it all mapped out in a definitive way in advance, because grace is that which always goes before I can lay claim to anything. God loves me into being as a creature and calls me into a relationship with God and relationships with others in loving kindness in the world. And yeah, that is the living out of grace, not having it all mapped out in the right theology. And I think that, you know, the longer I live and try to be a theologian, the more I realize the limitations of theology and the true infinite mystery of God. And I think it fits, you know, the gospel stories, how Jesus is constantly calling the pretense of people around him into question. You say this, but I say this, you know. Healing on the Sabbath, well, if I'm displaying the love of God, why is that a problem? I mean, that's the Tom Reynolds crass translation, but, you know, it's all those things puncture the illusions of, you know, and the pretense to have it all mapped out. And you know, in terms of the theology of disability, I think that it opens up multiple ways for human beings to find a spiritual center in ways that are beyond the control of what some community would deem acceptable or another. So I'm, you know, I resonate with your story, and I'm sorry you got that answer, but it sort of angers me in a way.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that God, and I pray he continues to do this, is to challenge my ignorance when I think I have it figured out. When I think I have him figured out, to that God will bring things along that do keep me humble, because that arrogance creates such a blindness to our being able to listen to God and to become more like him. And I wonder, you know, I'm okay with people challenging me, even if I feel that they're wrong, but because it gives me a chance to think about, what do I really think about this, you know? But I was wondering how would you answer the question, see if I can figure out a sort of simple way to say this, for someone who would say, you know, why would God allow someone to be born disabled? Or why, you know, because they have to suffer, and their family has to suffer. And that, you know, of course, these why questions are all, you know, I've always thought maybe I should stop asking why questions, but I mean, we're allowed to obviously ask them because the Psalms are full of that, but also they don't tend to stay helpful. They tend to, you know, maybe go to a bad place or go to a place that grows our faith. But for people who, I mean, I've run into this too, and on all kinds of ways of suffering, for people who are agnostic or struggling with God or atheists, that they'll say, you know, what kind of God would have your son be born like that, so that he suffers rejection and hardship, and then also you do. That, you know, I'm kind of amalgamating a bunch of things. No one's ever said that, but in that sense, like, as a theologian, how would you answer something like that? So what if I just leave that question dangling out there and hanging in a creative tension? I want to ask you that question as well and see what your responses are. You can stop by Spark My Muse in the comments section, sparkmymuse.com, and leave your comments and your thoughts, or you can go to facebook.com/sparkmymuse and get a conversation going. Tom has multiple answers for this question, and I thought his answers were fascinating, and the show got long enough that I thought it would be wise to split it into two parts. So come back next week for the second part, or just check to see if the second part has already been released. And thank you so much for listening to the episode today.